Chapter 12. Through the haze of the vapor came her voice, more musical, more plaintive than I had heard it before, but far softer, more tender. Still in her foreign tongue, the words unknown to me, and yet their sense, perhaps, made intelligible by the love, which has one common language and one common look to all who have loved, the love unmistakably heard in the loving tone, unmistakably seen in the loving face. A moment or so more, and she had come round from the opposite side of the fire pile, and bending over Margrove's upturned brow, kissed it quietly, solemnly, and then her countenance grew fierce, her crest rose erect. It was the lioness protecting her young. She stretched forth her arm from the black mantle, athwart the pale front, that now again bent over the cauldron, stretched it toward the haunted, and hollow-sounding space beyond, in the gesture of one whose right hand has the sway of the scepter. And then her voice stole on the air in the music of a chant, not loud yet far-reaching, so thrilling, so sweet and yet so solemn, that I could at once comprehend how legend united of old the spell of enchantment with the power of song. All that I recalled of the effects which, in the former time, Margrove's strange chants had produced on the ear, that they ravished, and the thoughts they confused, was but as the wild bird's imitative carol, compared to the depth and the art, and the soul of the singer, whose voice seemed endowed with a charm, to enthrall all the tribes of creation, though the language it used for that charm might to them, as to me, be unknown. As the song ceased, I heard from behind sounds like those I had heard in the spaces before me, the tramp of invisible feet, the whir of invisible wings, as if armies were marching, to aid against armies in march to destroy. "Look not in front nor around," said Ayesha. "Look, like him, on the cauldron below. The circle and the lamps are yet bright. I will tell you, when the light again fails." I dropped my eyes on the cauldron. "See," whispered Margrove, "the sparkles at last begin to arise, and the rose hues to deepen signs that we near the last process." Ix, the fifth hour had passed away, when Ayesha said to me, "Lo! The circle is fading, the lamps grow dim. Look now without fear on the space beyond. The eyes that appall thee are again lost in air, as lightnings that fleet back into cloud." I looked up, and the specters had vanished. The sky was tinged with sulphurous hues, the red and the black intermixed. I replenished the lamps and the ring in front, thriftily, heedfully. But when I came to the sixth lamp, not a drop in the vessel that fed them was left. In a vague dismay, I now looked round the half of the white circle in rear of the two bended figures intent on the cauldron. All along that disk the light was already broken, here and there flickering up, here and there dying down. The six lamps in that half of the circle still twinkled, but faintly, as stars shrinking fast from the dawn of day. But it was not the fading shine in that half of the magical ring which daunted my eye, and quickened with terror the pulse of my heart. The bushland beyond was on fire. From the background of the forest rose the flame and the smoke, there, still half smothering the flame. But along the width of the grasses and herbage, between the verge of the forest, and the bed of the water creek just below the raised platform from which I beheld the dread conflagration, the fire was advancing wave upon wave, clear and red against the columns of rock behind, as the rush of a flood through the mists of some alp crowned with lightnings. Roused from my stun at the first sight of a danger not foreseen by the mind I had steeled against far rarer portents of nature, I cared no more for the lamps and the circle. Hurrying back to Ayesha, I exclaimed, "The phantoms have gone from the spaces in front, but what incantation or spell can arrest the red march of the foe speeding on in the rear?" While we gazed on the cauldron of life, behind us, unheeded, behold the destroyer. Ayesha looked and made no reply, but, as by involuntary instinct, bowed her majestic head, then rearing it erect, placed herself yet more immediately before the wasted form of the young magician. He still, bending over the cauldron, and hearing me not in the absorption and hope of his watch, placed herself before him, as the bird whose first care is her fledgling. As we two there stood, fronting the deluge of fire, we heard Margrave behind us, murmuring low, "See the bubbles of light, how they sparkle, and dance. I shall live, I shall live." And his words scarcely died in our ears before, crash upon crash, came the fall of the age-long trees in the forest, and near, all near us, through the blazing grasses, the hiss of the serpents, the scream of the birds, and the bellow and tramp of the herds plunging wild through the billowy red of their pastures. Ayesha now wound her arms around Margrave, and wrenched him, reluctant and struggling, from his watch over the seething cauldron. In rebuke of his angry exclamations, she pointed to the march of the fire, spoke in sorrowful tones a few words in her own language, and then, appealing to me in English, said, "I tell him that, here, the spirits who oppose us have summoned a foe that is deaf to my voice, and," exclaimed Margrave, no longer with gasp and effort, but with the swell of a voice which drowned all the discords of terror and of agony sent forth from the phlegethon burning below, "and this witch, whom I trusted, is a vile slave and impostor, more desiring my death than my life. She thinks that in life I should scorn and forsake her, that in death I should die in her arms. Sorceress, avaunt! Art thou useless and powerless now, when I need thee most? Go! Let the world be one funeral pyre. What to me is the world? My world is my life. Thou knowest that my last hope is here, that all the strength left me this night will die down, like the lamps in the circle, unless the elixir restore it. Bold friend, spurn that sorceress away. Hours yet ere those flames can assail us. A few minutes more, and life to your Lillian and me." Thus having said, Margrave turned from us, and cast into the cauldron the last essence yet left in his empty coffer. Ayesha silently drew her black veil over her face, and turned, with the being she loved, from the terror he scorned, to share in the hope that he cherished. Thus left alone, with my reason disenthralled, disenchanted, I surveyed more calmly the extent of the actual peril with which we were threatened, and the peril seemed less, so surveyed. It is true, all the bushland behind, almost up to the bed of the creek, was on fire, but the grasses, through which the flame spread so rapidly, ceased at the opposite marge of the creek. Watery pools were still, at intervals, left in the bed of the creek, shining tremulous, like waves of fire, in the glare reflected from the burning land, and even where the water failed, the stony course of the exhausted rivulet was a barrier against the march of the conflagration. Thus, unless the wind, now still, should rise, and waft some sparks to the parched combustible herbage immediately around us, we were saved from the fire, and our work might yet be achieved. I whispered to Ayesha the conclusion to which I came. "Thinkest thou," she answered without raising her mournful head, "that the agencies of nature are the movements of chance? The spirits I invoke to his aid are leagued with the hosts that assail. A mightier than I am has doomed him." Scarcely had she uttered these words before Margrave exclaimed, "Behold how the rose of the alchemist's dream enlarges its blooms from the folds of its petals. I shall live, I shall live." I looked, and the liquid which glowed in the cauldron had now taken a splendor that mocked all comparisons borrowed from the luster of gems. In its prevalent color it had, indeed, the dazzle and flash of the ruby, but out from the mass of the molten red, broke coruscations of all prismal hues, shooting, shifting, in a play that made the wavelets themselves seem living things, sensible of their joy. No longer was there scum or film upon the surface, only ever and anon a light, rosy vapor floating up, and quick lost in the haggard, heavy, sulphurous air, hot with the conflagration rushing toward us from behind. And these coruscations formed, on the surface of the molten ruby, literally the shape of a rose, its leaves made distinct in their outlines by sparks of emerald and diamond and sapphire. Even while gazing on this animated liquid luster, a buoyant delight seemed infused into my senses. All terrors conceived before were annulled. The phantoms, whose armies had filled the wide spaces in front, were forgotten. The crash of the forest behind was unheard. and the reflection of that glory. Margrove's wan cheek seemed already restored to the radiance it wore when I saw it first in the framework of blooms. As I gazed, thus enchanted, a cold hand touched my own. "Hush," whispered Ayesha, from the black veil, against which the rays of the cauldron fell blunt and absorbed into dark. "Behind us, the light of the circle is extinct, but there, we are guarded from all, save the brutal and soulless destroyers. But before, see, two of the lamps have died out. See the blank of the gap in the ring. Guard that breach there, the demons will enter. Not a drop is there left in this vessel by which to replenish the lamps on the ring. Advance, then. Thou hast still the light of the soul, and the demons may recoil before a soul that is dauntless and guiltless. If not, three are lost. As it is, one is doomed." Thus adjured, silently, involuntarily, I passed from the veiled woman's side, over the sear lines on the turf which had been traced by the triangles of light long since extinguished, and toward the verge of the circle. As I advanced, overhead rushed a dark cloud of winged birds dislodged from the forest on fire, and screaming, in dissonant terror, as they flew toward the farthermost mountains. Close by my feet hissed, and glided the snakes, driven forth from their blazing coverts, and glancing through the ring, unscared by its waning lamps, all undulating by me, bright-eyed, and hissing, all made innocuous by fear even the terrible death adder, which I trampled on as I halted at the verge of the circle, did not turn to bite, but crept harmless away. I halted at the gap between the two dead lamps, and bowed my head, to look again into the crystal vessel. Were there, indeed, no lingering drops yet left, if but to recruit the lamps for some priceless minutes more? As I thus stood, right into the gap between the two dead lamps strode a gigantic foot. All the rest of the form was unseen. Only, as volume after volume of smoke poured on from the burning land behind, it seemed as if one great column of vapor, eddying round, settled itself aloft from the circle, and that out from that column, strode the giant foot. And, as strode the foot, so with it came, like the sound of its tread, a roll of muttered thunder. I recoiled, with a cry, that rang loud through the lurid air. "Courage," said the voice of Ayesha. "Trembling soul, yield not an inch to the demon." At the charm, the wonderful charm, in the tone of the veiled woman's voice, my will seemed to take a force more sublime than its own. I folded my arms on my breast, and stood as if rooted to the spot, confronting the column of smoke and the stride of the giant foot. And the foot halted, mute. Again, in the momentary hush of that suspense, I heard a voice. It was Margrove's. "The last hour expires, the work is accomplished. Come, come, aid me to take the cauldron from the fire, and, quick, or a drop may be wasted in vapor the elixir of life from the cauldron." At that cry I receded, and the foot advanced. And at that moment, suddenly, unawares, from behind, I was stricken down. Over me, as I lay, swept a whirlwind of trampling hoofs and glancing horns. The herds, in their flight from the burning pastures, had rushed over the bed of the watercourse, scaled the slopes of the banks. Snorting and bellowing, they plunged their blind way to the mountains. One cry alone, more wild than their own savage blare, pierced the reek through which the brute hurricane swept. At that cry of wrath and despair I struggled to rise, again dashed to earth by the hoofs and the horns. But was it the dreamlike deceit of my reeling senses, or did I see that giant foot stride past through the close serried ranks of the maddening herds? Did I hear, distinct through all the huge uproar of animal terror, the roll of low thunder which followed the stride of that foot? X, when my sense had recovered its shock, and my eyes looked dizzily round, the charge of the beasts had swept by. And of all the wild tribes which had invaded the magical circle, the only lingerer was the brown death adder, coiled close by the spot where my head had rested. Beside the extinguished lamps which the hoofs had confusedly scattered, the fire, arrested by the watercourse, had consumed the grasses that fed it, and there the plain stretched black and desert as the phlegrean field of the poet's hell. But the fire still raged in the forest beyond white flames, soaring up from the trunks of the tallest trees, and forming, through the sullen dark of the smoke wreck, innumerable pillars of fire, like the halls in the city of fiends. Gathering myself up, I turned my eyes from the terrible pomp of the lurid forest, and looked fearfully down on the hoof-trampled sward for my two companions. I saw the dark image of Ayesha still seated, still bending, as I had seen it last. I saw a pale hand feebly grasping the rim of the magical cauldron, which lay, hurled down from its tripod by the rush of the beasts, yards away from the dim, fading embers of the scattered wood pyre. I saw the faint writhings of a frail, wasted frame, over which the veiled woman was bending. I saw, as I moved with bruised limbs to the place, close by the lips of the dying magician, the flash of the ruby-like essence spilled on the sword, and, meteor-like, sparkling up from the torn tufts of herbage. I now reached Margrove's side. Bending over him as the veiled woman bent, and as I sought gently to raise him, he turned his face, fiercely faltering out, "Touch me not, rob me not. You share with me. Never, never. These glorious drops are all mine. Die all else. I will live, I will live." Writhing himself from my pitying arms, he plunged his face amidst the beautiful, playful flame of the essence, as if to lap the elixir with lips scorched away from its intolerable burning. Suddenly, with a low shriek, he fell back, his face upturned to mine, and on that face unmistakably rained death. Then Ayesha tenderly, silently, drew the young head to her lap, and it vanished from my sight behind her black veil. I knelt beside her, murmuring some trite words of comfort, but she heeded me not, rocking herself to and fro as the mother who cradles a child to sleep. Soon the fast flickering sparkles of the lost elixir died out on the grass, and with their last sportive diamond-like tremble of light, up, in all the suddenness of Australian day, rose the sun, lifting himself royally above the mountaintops, and fronting the meaner blaze of the forest as a young king fronts his rebels. And as there, where the bushfires had ravaged, all was a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.